Start again. Our panel this morning is titled Decentralism and Statism in the Experience of Greece, Rome, and Christendom. Of these three civilizations, the latter two have been able to send representatives, and I will take it upon myself to speak briefly of the first. On the Romans, we're pleased to have Professor Christian Kopp, who teaches in the honors program at the University of Colorado. Professor Kopp was born in Brooklyn, went to college at Haverford, and received his PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is the author of the book, The Devil Knows Latin, Why America Needs the Classical Tradition, published by ISI, and also of numerous articles and reviews. And he is the recipient of grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities, who, he tells me, sent him to Rome during the Gulf War. Whether his next book will be The Devil Knows Arabic or The Angels Know Greek, we'll have to ask him in the question period. On Christendom, we're fortunate to welcome Professor John P. McCarthy, who's professor of history and director of the Institute for Irish Studies at Fordham University. He received his BA from Fordham, his master's from the University of Chicago, and his PhD from Columbia University. Author of Hilaire Belloc, Edwardian Radical, and Descent from Irish America, and also editor of a volume of Chesterton's works, and author of numerous articles and reviews, he has appeared as a commentator on Irish affairs and Irish American affairs on CNN, PBS, the BBC, the CBC, and RTE in Ireland. Allow me now to speak for about 7 minutes and then yield the floor to our presenters for about 15 to 20 minutes each, and that should allow us ample time for questions. The title of my remarks this morning is Why Great Minds Praise Small Places. Among many of our conservative friends, or at least among many of my conservative friends, not to mention among our fellow citizens of different political stripe, to look with anything more than a tourist's interest on the decentralized, the regional, and the local, is to make oneself an object of suspicion or derision. This has been especially true in the 20th century, of course, during which Americans seemed always preoccupied with big things. But this way of thinking actually goes back to the founding of the federal government. Publius, the alias assumed by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay when writing the Federalist Papers, regularly refers to state politicians as self-interested and small-minded. In contrast to the enlightened statesmen, together with whom two of them wrote the Constitution of 1787. Publius thought that Republican government had been given a bad name by the constant disorder and faction in what he called, when he wanted to be nice, the, quote, petty republics of Greece and Rome, and when he wanted to be mean, quote, the Greek and Roman anarchies. Extend the sphere, wrote James Madison, and, quote, a coalition of the majority of society could seldom take place on any other principles than those of justice and the general good. Republican government, for Madison and Hamilton too, could only be good government if the republic is large. But even, or precisely, to the admirers of Publius, it ought to give pause that the greatest political philosophers of classical antiquity, those who could least of all be accused of being small-minded or unenlightened on any point, considered on reflection that the best political order for human beings was the polis. As others have pointed out, Plato and Aristotle knew about larger societies. They had the Persian Empire before their eyes, and Aristotle knew intimately the growing Macedonian Empire. And they certainly did not lack political imagination. But they both considered the question of the best regime as the question of the best order for the polis, a society or city-state whose total population would rarely have exceeded 100,000, and the number of whose full citizens was much smaller yet. Plato, in his more practical book, The Laws, fixes the number of households in his city at 5,040, and while Aristotle in the Politics writes that the city must be surveyable at a single glance, and that, like a ship, too big or too small a city would not be a city at all. Both Plato and Aristotle acknowledged, of course, that the city was something more than an extended family. It could not depend for its identity simply on a common inheritance of blood or custom, on all that belongs to the familiar. It must be anchored instead in an articulated account of what is just or unjust, noble or ignoble, advantageous or harmful. But the openness of the city to universal principles did not entail its openness to universal membership. Indeed, they recognized every actual regime as partial, both in the sense of its being partisan and in the sense of its encompassing only a part of the human whole. Why did the polis have a limit to its proper size? Let me suggest four reasons, and then I'll sit down. First, the polis, and most especially the citizen soldiers who constituted its core, were thought to require homonoia, sameness of mind, or agreement. As Paul Ray has shown brilliantly in his very big book, Republics Ancient and Modern, this was the essence of the Spartan model, and it depended on a shared education that would be possible only among a few. Even in cities less regimented than Sparta, however, a certain agreement was thought essential. Aristotle writes, for example, that men deliberate about means, but not about ends, not about what we would today call values. Supposing, Aristotle does, that in any city, ends are shared, or at any rate, authoritatively established. The city is bigger than the family, for these philosophers, but it depends upon friendship. And while friendliness can be directed generally, friendship is reserved for such a number as can share their lives together and know one another over time. And the noblest friendship, based on virtue, is generally possible only among those who agree on what virtue is. A second and closely related reason for the smallness of the polis is the need for active consent. Consent is not the first principle of classical political philosophy. That is surely the supreme authority of virtue or reason. But once one moves away from the fully rational and so fully coercive ideal of Plato's Republic toward the voluntarist metaphysic of the laws, and likewise in Aristotle, consent becomes a necessary prerequisite of any just political order. For example, Aristotle at times seems to distinguish the king from the tyrant, surely a fundamental distinction, to distinguish them by nothing more than whether he gained his office with the people's consent or in the face of public opposition. Modern writers make consent the first principle of the organization of government in theory, but then find infinite ways to infer consent to the Leviathan in practice. Aristotle, by contrast, considers it a worthy objection to the ready alteration of the laws that such change in law would require law enforcement, and among a free people, this is to be minimized, if not avoided. The third reason for limiting the size of the polis is to support the possibility of prudence or political wisdom. This was implied in Aristotle's comments about surveyability, and it appears in both the Laws and the Republic, where Plato makes the guardians or the guardian of education a high officer and charges him with knowing the souls of the citizens, particularly one by one. It is not enough to know what virtue is. In the ancient Greek city, you have to know who has it. Indeed, in defining prudence, Aristotle points to particular prudent men rather than specifying abstract attributes. Prudence itself is a knowledge of particulars, and it consists especially in making good judgments about these. To be sure, prudence extends beyond the boundaries of the city to include prudence in the conduct of the city among other cities. Aristotle's model of prudence, Pericles, was famously an author of the Athenian Empire. And in Thucydides, we see Pericles not only direct his fellow citizens to look at the glory of Athens, what is surveyable, but also to ask them to keep in mind the unseen web of relations overseas on which Athenian prosperity and Athenian glory depend. In Themistocles and Alcibiades, Thucydides gives us prudent men whose prudence seems to travel from city to city. They not only advise their native fellow citizens, but the enemy Spartans, and even the Persian king. But I don't believe Plato or Aristotle ever makes either of these a model of prudence, nor does Thucydides, for that matter. Perhaps they are even the exceptions that prove the rule. Finally, the greatest political thinkers of the Greek world could be satisfied with the little polis because they knew something that transcended the city. They knew philosophy, or the search for the nature of things, which was not bounded by the city, and which they thought begins in earnest only when opinions about the good and the just, as defined by the city, come under scrutiny. The small-mindedness of the city thus became for them in practice a typical precondition for the emergence of the large-mindedness of philosophy. It was not the only precondition. Political philosophy, at least, emerged not in Sparta, but in democratic imperial Athens, as though philosophy needed a city large-minded enough for its small-mindedness to be a live public issue. Still, the polis as polis was too small to make itself the sole and worthy object of ambition for the great-souled men. We moderns have made bigger cities, to be sure, but I think it remains a live question for us whether these have not often imprisoned souls by their very bigness, by the anonymity they require among their inhabitants, and the fantasies they inspire in those who administer them. How did the polis become something big? That's a question I think our subsequent panelists will now address. First, Professor Cox.